Audiobook Empire presents The Flight of the Kingfisher. He was sitting on the floor at her feet, his heart in his throat, almost as nervous as he'd been watching her fight, the same sense of sweaty palms and agitation, all at once, in a single moment. What was he doing? He was easy. That was what he'd learned. As long as he was easy, gave people what they wanted of himself, made them comfortable, made them happy, everything was okay. It was easy. This wasn't easy. It was never going to be easy. But even as he rebelled against it with an intense panic surge, he realized it was also true. Maybe the most truthful he'd been in his life with another person. "I have feelings for you, Carbon," he said. "I don't know why or how. And I know that you've made it clear that you're not even there." "What does that mean?" she cut in. "Have feelings for me." She was so smart and so strong. He did like strong women. But she was so innocent, painfully innocent. Even saying the words felt like taking advantage in a way he couldn't have articulated. "I'm attracted to you," he said. "And I care about what happens to you. I want you to be happy." He rolled forward over his crossed ankles, shifting up onto his knees. "Just don't hit me, okay?" he said as she watched him. Was this the closest he'd ever been to her? It had to have been, right? No, he'd done her armor. Where was her armor? She wasn't wearing it. He could feel the shape of her kneecap against his hip. She was still watching him. He put a hand out, very genuinely afraid that she might break it, and touched her chin with his fingertips, drawing her face forward, gently. Her skin was so soft. He put his lips to hers, then let her go, sitting back on his heels again. "Harper, what is my status as a member of the crew?" she asked. He frowned. That was not what he had been expecting. "Captain Montauk changed you to a full member of the crew before landing," Harper answered. Carbon stood, sliding sideways away from Avery and looking at the door. "Harper, privacy protocol bound and gagged," she said. "Privacy protocol changed to bound and gagged," Harper said. Carbon nodded, edging one step closer to the door and turning her shoulders to face Avery even as her feet pointed at the door. "Annalise," she said. "What?" he asked. "My name," she said. "The one they took from me. It's Annalise." And then she was gone. The Justice of the Duke. They were alone. A deadly smile flickered on his lips as he raised his weapons and fell on guard. He was a gentleman trained in arms, was this Beltrame, and easy, he thought, should be to him the slaughter of a scribbling poet, a man versed in no weapon but the goose quill. Yet his certainty of victory was based on an even surer measure of precaution. His valor sprang from another advantage, an advantage that made him no better than a murderer, as you shall learn. Sword and dagger met dagger and sword, parted, met again, circled, flashed, struck fire, were locked an instant, and once more were parted. For some 5 minutes they fought on. The sweat gathered on Beltrame's brow, and he breathed a prayer of thanks to a heaven that surely did not heed him for the secret advantage that was his. Without that, it would almost seem that this scrivener must prove his better. They fell back to breathe a moment, each welcoming the brief respite, for each was winded by the fierce vigor of the onslaught. Then they engaged once more, and Angelo knew in his heart that he was Beltrame's master. But that he held his hand, Angelo might have slain his adversary a score of times had the latter had a score of lives to lose. But he was gentle as he was skilled, and he could not seek the life of the man who had been his friend. Instead, he sought Beltrame's sword arm. If he could drive a foot or so of steel through it, there would be an end to the encounter, and by the time the wound was healed, he would see to it that their difference was healed also. He would reason with this hot-headed Beltrame during the season of his convalescence and seek to induce him out of his murderous jealousy. Suddenly, Beltrame's point came like a snake at Angelo's throat. Angelo was no more than in time to turn the thrust aside, and the viciousness that could aim so at a vital spot stirred his anger anew. It also awoke him to a sense of his own danger. Unless he disabled Beltrame soon, his life would pay the price of his generosity. Beltrame was the stronger and was showing less fatigue. Unless he went in soon, he might not go in at all. Since he could not reach the arm, he would take Beltrame there, high up in the right breast, above the lung, where little damage could be done. Thus, he parried a sharp thrust, delivered rather high, and on the binding of the blade went in and up with a stroke that he had learned from the famous Costanzo of Milan, who had been his precipiter in the art of swordsmanship. His point went home unwarded. But instead of sinking through unresisting flesh, it struck something that jarred and numbed his arm, and on the stroke his rapier snapped, and he was left with a hilt and a stump of steel. Beltrame laughed, and Angelo understood. The Neapolitan wore a shirt of mail, one of those meshes so much in fashion then, so fine that your two hands might encompass and conceal it, and yet so finely tempered as to be proof against the stoutest stroke of sword or dagger.
The Many Escapes of Hugo Pembroke. Lifting the glass of wine for a cautious sip, Arthur settled in to see what approach Pembroke would choose. He'd already gone through the obvious, so perhaps next he might try to reveal details of his disagreement with Lord Cartland that would paint the Duke in a bad enough light that Arthur could be convinced to break his agreement. Unlikely, but Arthur couldn't help but be a little curious. Had the Duke attacked his son? Had there perhaps been a girl caught in the middle, which His Grace had disapproved of? It was always something like that when it came to rich boys. That was rather to be expected, really, from the wealthy. What Arthur hadn't been expecting was for Pembroke to throw his glass of wine into Arthur's face, kick one of the legs of the chair so it collapsed, dumping him in a heap, then jump over him like a horse in an exhibition, bolting for the door. The infuriating part was that Arthur should have expected that. It took him precious seconds to untangle himself from the broken chair and thunder out of the room. By the time he'd gotten to the hallway, Pembroke was already nearly to the stairs. Arthur's height and longer stride allowed him to catch up and snatch his arm, but the man twisted like a bloody eel, wrenching away harshly enough that his elbow knocked on the wall. Pembroke hissed, but didn't spare the time to cradle the injury. He was already stepping back, eyes narrowed on Arthur, shoulders hunched.
"Pembroke,"
Arthur started, trying to be reasonable. Pembroke was slight of build. If Arthur was too rough, he very well might badly hurt him, and he didn't want to do that because the Duke might dock the fee if Arthur returned his offspring somewhat the worse for wear. But also, Pembroke seemed, by all accounts, to be a good man. There were no personal feelings here. Arthur didn't want to engender any due to his own actions.
"We don't need to make this difficult."
"I agree," Pembroke said steadily, backing away towards the stairs. "Stay there, and I will go my way, and we can stay friends."
Arthur tilted his head, resigning himself to the unpleasantness.
"Even if you leave now, I'll find you again. And then I'll just be irritated."
I really care little for your feelings at the moment, I'm sorry to say.
Arthur exhaled.
I'm sorry too, then.
He lunged forward and caught Pembroke by the front of his coat. Shockingly, Pembroke jumped closer and brought a knee up, aiming for Arthur's cock and balls. Understanding with a chill that this was going to be neither a fair nor easy fight, Arthur slammed his thighs closed and caught that knee before it could do any harm. Twisting to the side, he tumbled Pembroke harshly to the floorboards and threw himself on top, crushing him under his greater body weight. Pembroke had clearly had some form of training, something much more brutal and efficient than a gentleman's token fist fighting. Trapped under Arthur, he threw back an elbow that Arthur only just managed to dodge by angling his head to the side. He saved his nose, but the sharp elbow caught him painfully on the side of the jaw, stinging, a little stunning. Arthur growled and shifted, grasping Pembroke's wrists and pinning them to the floorboards. Underneath him, Pembroke froze for but a fraction of a second. Arthur saw him inhale deeply and he released one wrist to hurriedly press a hand to his mouth, muffling the scream.
Stop,
he hissed.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Yearbook by Seth Rogen. About 4 hours into the meeting, it finally came up. The conversation slowly veered into how the public thought he was losing his mind.
Well, yeah, they're making it seem like I'm losing my mind.
Making it seem like it?
Yeah, there's a coordinated effort to make it appear that way.
Who would do that?
The pharmaceutical industry.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Ed, why would they do that?
Because my exposure of their fraud has cost them so much money that they're desperate. They're scrambling and they're doing everything they can to discredit me so I won't hurt sales anymore.
Big Pharma made you jump on Oprah's couch?
They edited it to make it look so much worse than it was. They do that all the time. You should see what they do to my friend Louis Farrakhan.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Philosophy 101. In one of his most well-known texts, The Republic, Plato sets out to demonstrate how human perception exists without anyone being aware of the existence of forms, and how true knowledge is only gained through philosophy. Any knowledge gained by the senses is not knowledge at all, but simply opinion. The allegory of the cave reads as a conversation between Socrates and Plato's brother, Glaucon. In the dialogue, Socrates asks Glaucon to imagine a world where an illusion is perceived as reality. To further his point, he creates the following example. There exists a cave where, inside, a group of prisoners has been locked up since birth. These prisoners cannot move. Their necks and legs are chained so that they can't shift or turn around and they can only see what is in front of them, a stone wall. Behind and above the prisoners is a fire, and between the fire and the prisoners is a low wall where people walk, carrying objects on their heads. The light of the fire casts shadows on the objects onto the wall in front of the prisoners. These shadows are all the prisoners can see. The only sounds they hear are the echoes from the cave. Now, because these prisoners have never been exposed to the actual objects and all their lives they have only witnessed the shadows, they mistake these shadows for reality. The echoes of the cave, to them, are noises created by the shadows. If a shadow of a book were to appear, for example, these prisoners would claim that they have seen a book. They are not saying this is a shadow of a book because their reality doesn't know shadows. Eventually, one of the prisoners would understand the nature of this world and would be able to guess what shadow would come next, which would lead to praise and recognition from the other prisoners. Now, let's suppose one of the prisoners is set free. If a person were to show that prisoner an actual book, the prisoner would not be able to recognize it. To the prisoner, a book is the shadow that was cast on the wall. The illusion of a book seems more real than the book itself. Socrates continues,
pondering what would happen if that freed prisoner were to then turn toward the fire. The prisoner would surely turn away from so much light and turn back to the dark shadows, which he holds to be more real. Steerforth Press presents Back from the Deep: How Gene and Sandy Ralston Serve the Living by Finding the Dead. And then, about 20 minutes into that first search line of their last day on Alouette Lake, Gene said matter-of-factly, "I think we have a body." He zoomed in on something close to the edge of the sonar image. He was scanning with a 131-foot range out the port side of the Towfish. The left side of the monitor displayed a narrow strip of black, which represented the area directly below the steel torpedo.
"Wow. Wow. Wow."
Pete repeated the words softly. "I'm not saying it is, but that's the best thing we've seen yet," Gene said. The object on the screen was not much bigger than a thumbtack. I had seen a similar form scroll into view 2 years before when the Ralstons imaged Alexander Bravo Morikine on the bottom of a lake in Washington State. The head, torso, and legs were clearly visible. We were near the spot where the east shoreline expanded into the first basin. The Ralstons had stopped just shy of scanning this far north yesterday. It looked like we were within the area described by Rick Sandu and his friends, but the boundary they had used at this end was trickier to judge because it was more general. The widening of the lake versus the one to the south, a big rock on shore. Gene recorded the location in the navigation program and then raised the Towfish a couple hundred feet so Sandy could turn the boat around to scan it from the other direction.
"Did your heart skip a beat, or are you trying to stay calm?" Gene asked. "It skipped a beat," Pete said.
The atmosphere on board was hushed as we approached the target from the south. Gene murmured course corrections to Sandy. A graphic on the monitor showed that the boat was passing over the object, but the Towfish was still several hundred feet behind us. The more cable that was needed to reach the bottom, the farther back the Towfish got pulled behind the boat. We watched the bottom inch down the monitor. Tick. 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 Tick.
"We're not going to have a lot of wiggle room," Gene said.
The deeper the lake, the more challenging the recovery. The ROV had 500 feet of umbilical cable. The depth sounder read 428 feet. The deepest recovery the Ralstons had ever done was in 375 feet of water. "Boom!" Gene clapped his hands. "Make the call." The image of the body was brighter and better defined on the second pass. A sizable log lay flat on the otherwise empty lake floor about 10 to 15 feet west of the corpse.
"You sure?"
Sandy asked.
"That's a body," Gene said.
Thank you very much. This has been Wesley Scott.